Thanks, Vanessa, and good morning to everybody. I'm glad to see everybody here. So let's get started. The IBRI is a catalyst for collaboration, and the goal is to convene industry and academic research institutions, getting them together to share insights on the problems that need to be investigated. IBRI then finds new and innovative ways to have these various groups of people work together to solve these pressing health problems, which Vanessa mentioned are important here in Indiana, but actually beyond. So our first speaker today exemplifies the goal and expectations of the IBRI's visionary founders. Desio Iziric, with his international reputation for innovative research and his ability to create connections with other world-renowned researchers to advance our understanding of diabetes, is an exciting new addition to the Lilly Diabetes Center of Excellence at the IBRI. Dr. Iziric is a full professor and director of the Université Libre de Bruxelles Center for Diabetes Research in Brussels, Belgium, and a member of the ULB Medical Faculty. He recently joined the IBRI as a research fellow. You'll see his full bio sketch in the program. It's my pleasure to welcome my colleague Desio to the stage and introduce him to you this morning. So, Desio.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot, Bob. Well, this is a very nice introduction, and I hope I am going to live up to your expectations. Just before I start, as you may have noticed, I am starting a nice cold, so forgive if my voice crack a little bit. This phrase was it was stated by a young girl with an autoimmune disease called lupus. And what she said, which I think is very moving, is when your own immune system attacks you, there is no way to hide. And I think this is what we are dealing here. We are dealing with autoimmune diseases where the immune system goes wrong and attack our own cells. And the particular disease that I and some of the other colleagues at the IBRI are interested is type 1 diabetes mellitus, where the targets are the pancreatic beta cells. And something goes wrong. We still do not understand why things go wrong, but what happens is that the immune system attacks, starts to perceive the pancreatic beta cells as a foreign cell and starts to attack it. And this attack is mediated by cell-to-cell contact. For instance, these cells will bind to the beta cells and deliver toxic substance that will kill them. And it will also be done by, for instance, macrophages that will release cytokines like interferons, tumor necrosis factor, interleukin-1, that will bind to the surface of the beta cells and lead to beta cell death. And as the beta cells die, and this is a progressive process, eventually the patient will lose most of her or his beta cells, and at that stage they will be insulin dependent for life. And this is a major public health problem. So if we look in the world today, there are more than 400 million people living with diabetes mellitus. 5 to 10% have type 1. If we look at the US, US alone, we have here around 1.25 million children and adults affected by type 1. And one thing that is particularly concerned is that the incidence and the prevalence of the disease is doubling every 25 years. So, for instance, if in Europe, the number of cases, of new cases per year, have been doubling every 25 years, and we really do not understand why. And to make things even worse, the incidence of the disease is increasing, but we cannot prevent it. So what we can do is treat it after the beta cells have been killed. And this has an enormous cost. So the total cost of diabetes care in the US is around $325 billion. And this is all over the world the same way. So for instance, I have a lot of collaboration with China. And I think in China, the public health system is going to crack they just do not have the capabilities to deal with this type of budget. And this is one of the challenges that the IBRI needs to face. So how to understand better the pathogenesis of type 1, and not only in an abstract way, but how to understand in a way that we can translate it to novel therapies. And I think we will need to really focus on the goals of the Institute, which include the discovery and development of innovative solutions to improve health, initially targeting several diseases, including the one I am particularly interested in. The vision is to build a world-class team of people that will work together, but will work together with a translational focus. And these three key values that I think really should be placed together. And when we try to understand why it's taking so long to discover a way to prevent or revert disease, in my view, one of the limitations of the field have been that we have focused only on the immune system. So this is an autoimmune disease where the immune system attacks beta cells, and most of the work in the field have been on understanding which are the components of the immune system that attack beta cells and how to prevent it. And this led to several attempts of therapy, and the latest one was published a couple of months ago. Basically, these colleagues used a drug that attacked T cells, is one of the cells that will attack the beta cells. And this was one of the first trials where the drug was used before the clinical disease started. So they took people who were autoantibody positive but were not yet hyperglycemic and gave this drug with the hope to prevent disease. And this was in the New York Times, it was heralded as a big success, but I am not convinced that this is a big success. I mean, there is a delay in the start of the disease, but these are the people in the placebo group, these are the people that received the drug. They are developing disease at the same slope. There is just a 1 to 2 years delay. So is this a big success? And we are dealing with children here, where we are giving to them a heavy immunosuppressive drugs. So I think we should be able to do better than this. And one of the reasons, as I told you, that I think we have so limited success is that we forget that when we are speaking about type 1, we are speaking of a dialogue between the invading immune cells and the pancreatic beta cells. So this is not a one-sided road. It's not a situation where the beta cells are just inert victims of the immune system. What we have shown over the years is that there is a crosstalk between the invading immune cells and the pancreatic beta cells. So the pancreatic beta cells provide signals to the immune system that will attract it and will make it aggressive against the pancreatic beta cells. And most of our research line has been focusing in understanding which are the signals that are generated inside the beta cells that will communicate to the immune system. So I think this is one of the limitations of the field up to now, that we have been focusing only on the immune system and not so much on the beta cells. And this is something that we are working to change. And the other issue, and I let you look at the cartoon on your own time. I think the other problem that we have had in this field is that we rely too much on mouse models. I think mouse models are precious. In several diseases, they are very, very useful. But particularly in type 1, it has not delivered. So the best animal model that we have is called the NOD mice. It's a wonderful model. And today there are more than 500 therapies that prevent disease in NOD mice. In humans, we have zero. So none of these therapies developed and validated in NOD mice translated. So I think perhaps this is not the best way to go. And when I am saying that beta cells are important and there is a dialogue between beta cells and the immune system, why do I say this? So I would like to share with you some data to support this concept. So this is the list of the known candidate genes for type 1 diabetes mellitus. As many autoimmune diseases, they have a major genetic component. So for instance, if you have a monozygotic twin with type 1, the other monozygotic twin will have around 50% chance of developing disease. And these are the genes that contribute to this disease. And until a few years ago, the idea was that most of these genes act at the immune system level. And we do a lot of functional genomic studies. So we look at all genes that human islets of Langerhans express. And we ask the very simple question, how many of these genes are present in human beta cells? And to our surprise, more than 80% of the candidate genes for type 1 are expressed in human islets of Langerhans, and they change expression when they are exposed to inflammatory stimuli. And we went to study these candidate genes in detail. And this is a very long story that I am going to make short. Basically, what we found is that these candidate genes at the beta cell level, they regulate the dialogue with the immune system, and they regulate the way in which beta cells sense danger signals. For instance, several of these candidate genes, this PRR stands for pattern recognition receptor, these candidate genes, they are involved in perceiving a viral infection and responding to it. These other candidate genes, and all that you see in red are genes that we have already studied. These other candidate genes, they are all involved in the dialogue with the immune system. These genes here regulate beta cell death. And there are only two genes that are involved in beta cell function. So it seems to be that most of these candidate genes at the beta cell level, they are involved in the dialogue with the immune system. And we have a paper that is just in press to come out in Nature Genetics in the coming weeks, where I think we found something very interesting. Because one of the big questions in autoimmune disease is that many of these candidate genes are common. So, for instance, somebody who has type 1 diabetes may have 30 to 50% of the candidate genes in common with rheumatoid arthritis. So the question is, why in one person this will lead to rheumatoid arthritis, and the other this will lead to type 1? And perhaps we may have found a hypothesis to explain this, suggesting that what happened is that transcription factors that regulate, for instance, in this case, beta cell function, when they bind to the chromatin, they open the chromatin and they enable pro-inflammatory transcription factors to bind. So this seems to be a cell-specific two-step response. And we are now comparing this with other diseases, particularly lupus, to see if this is a more general phenomenon. So how do we study this candidate gene? So up to now, what we do when we have a candidate gene that is expressed at the beta cell level, for instance, PTPN2 or TIC2, we basically overexpress it in human beta cells or knock it down and then see what's the function. But this is not really the best method. The best method would be to take cells or be able to take cells from healthy controls and from diabetic patients with the right polymorphism, with the right candidate genes, and to be able to study cells from these patients. It's ethically impossible to get beta cells. I mean, we get human islets of Langerhans in the context of islet transplantation. So we work together with a lab that does islet transplantation. So when somebody, for any unfortunate reason, for instance, get a car crash and is brain dead and is going to donate lung, heart, and so on, these colleagues take the pancreas, isolate the islets, and if they cannot be used for transplant, we are able to use them for research. But this is very rare material, and it's very difficult to get from the right genetic combination. So what we are doing now, and this is one of the programs that we are implanting here, is to derive beta cells from inducible pluripotent cells. So we are establishing a core at the IBRI to do this, and I think we have already all in place for this. So basically what we do is that we get skin fibroblasts or blood cells from the patient. We reprogram them from inducible pluripotent cells, and then we differentiate them to beta cells. They can be differentiated to beta cells, to liver, to neurons, and so on. And the other thing that is interesting is that there are today methods, one is called CRISPR-Cas, that allow you to correct the genetic difference between the healthy control and the patient. So what we can do now, we can, for instance, develop beta cell from a type 1 diabetic patient, and we can correct it so that we have in culture a perfect system. So we can have either the polymorphisms that contribute to disease, or this polymorphism is correct and the cell, let's say, similar to a control one. And this is from the same person. And this is a very good system to study mechanisms of disease and to do screening for drugs. Of course, this is easier to say than to do. So the differentiation of the cells into pre-beta cells, it's a very complicated process. It takes around 40 days. And basically what we do is try to reproduce the steps that happen in the human embryo in an accelerated way. And we go staining for all the transcription factors that mark each of these stages. And at the end, we get something that looks very much like a human islet of Langerhans. So this is staining for insulin in green, in red for a glucagon, and the nucleus you see is PDX1, which is a transcription factor that regulates beta cell function. And the next step is to see if the cells respond, for instance, to inflammatory stimuli, as adult beta cells respond. And this is ongoing work. But basically, what we have found is that when we expose this IPS-derived beta cells to cytokines that contribute to human disease, like interleukin-1 beta plus interferon gamma or interferon alpha, we see an increase in cell death, which is quite similar to what we see with adult human islets of Langerhans. So I think that this is a good system to use. And this is something that we'll have running here, I hope, in 1 or 2 months' time. And one last thing that I'd like to share with you is that we are studying the mechanism of disease. So we are studying not only the candidate genes, but the mediators of dysfunction of the beta cells. And one thing that we are trying to do is to focus on human disease. So instead of starting from NOD mice, we start from histology of human pancreas. We see what is happening on the human situation, and then we try to reproduce it on human islets of Langerhans. Because I think if we stick to the human model, we'll have much more chance to translate. And this type of interferon, it is interesting because when we do histology of the pancreas of type 1 diabetic patients, you see basically three things: overexpression of HLA class 1, which is a way that the beta cells present antigens to the immune system and cause them to be killed. We see presence of markers of endoplasmic reticulum stress, and we see beta cell death. And we also see that there is expression of interferon alpha in these islets of Langerhans. And when we expose human islets in vitro to interferon, we can reproduce all these phenomena that are present in the human pancreas. So how do we go here for the discovery of new drugs? The approach that we are taking, and this is something that we'll also develop here, it's a multi-omics approach. So we treat human beta cells, in this case, with interferon alpha. And we use three methods in parallel. One is RNA sequencing. So you sequence all RNA that the cells express. The other is proteomics. So we try to identify all proteins modified by interferon. And the third one is called ATAC-seq, which is a method that allows you to see opening of the chromatin. So you can see which areas of the chromatin open and how this leads to gene transcription and to protein translation. So this is all very, very nice, but is it relevant to human disease? I think it is. So last year, Teresa Mastracci, who is sitting there, we collaborated with her in this project. She had the opportunity to obtain islets from two patients with type 1 diabetes mellitus who unfortunately died. So she did the RNA sequencing of these patients, and we compared the RNA sequencing of the type 1 diabetic patients with the global gene expression of human islets exposed to interferon. And this color, red, indicates similarity in the overexpression genes. And there is indeed a major similarity between what we see with our in vitro treatment with what Teresa has observed in the islets from type 1. And this is not a non-specific stress, because if instead of using islets from type 1 diabetic patients, we do RNA-seq of islets from type 2 diabetic patients, there is no correlation whatsoever. So this is indeed a specific phenomenon. But how can you go from this very nice multi-omic story to the discovery of new drugs? Well, there are now some very interesting bioinformatic tools that we are using. And this is our own data set. So this is our RNA sequencing integrated with the proteomics. And the size of the letter are the pathways that we are finding. So we have interferon signaling, you have endoplasmic reticulum stress, and so on. So how can you go from these very broad data sets to drug discovery? Well, there is something that the Broad Institute in Boston did that is very, very useful. They have done RNA sequencing, so they characterized the expression of all genes on hundreds of cell lines exposed to drugs, drugs that can be, for instance, repurposed to other diseases. So what we do is we compare our data sets of human beta cells exposed to interferon with these data sets of other cell types exposed to drugs, and we try to identify drugs that mirror or that do the contrary of what interferon is doing. So the idea is to find drugs that are some of them already in use for other diseases that can block pathways that we are discovering. And just to exemplify, one of the drugs that we found is a blocker of JAK1. JAK1 is a kinase that is involved in interferon signaling. And it's interesting because these drugs, they are already being used to treat arthritis, but they are not used to treat type 1. So we exposed human islets of Langerhans to this drug, which is called baricitinib, and these cells, they are either under control condition or treated with interferon. So you do a dose response, and this dose here, 500 nanomolar, is what you get in the serum of patients treated with arthritis. And you can see that you can revert nearly all of the deleterious effects of interferon. So you can prevent HLA class 1 expression, which in theory should decrease presentation of antigens to the immune system. You can decrease CXCL10. CXCL10 is a chemokine. It's a protein that will call immune cells. So we can decrease expression of these cells, And here is a marker of ER stress. So by doing this global gene and protein analysis, and then using bioinformatic tools, we find a new drug. Well, not a new, a new drug. It's a drug that is well used. It is validated. It is already FDA approved for arthritis. But this drug may well be used in type 1. So we are now discussing with some colleagues to start a clinical trial with this drug. And we have already three other potential drugs in the pipeline discovered in this way. And one thing to keep in mind is that sometimes some of these drugs you cannot ideally give them systemically. You'd like to give them to the beta cells directly. And this is another of our research lines which I am going to move in here, which is to discover biomarkers that allow us to either image beta cells or hopefully to deliver drugs specifically to the beta cells. And this is one surface beta cell marker that we have discovered called DPP6. And this is human specific. So all our work by now is human specific. So we cannot image beta cells in the mouse. So this is a immunodeficient mouse where you can implant human islets of Langerhans. So we have implanted under the skin of the neck 1,000 or 3,000 islets of Langerhans. And here we implanted an irrelevant tissue. And we can see that by using a tracer for this surface marker, we are able to image these beta cells. And if we are able to image, hopefully we will be able to deliver drugs. And this is a system similar to the theranostic approach to cancer, where you try to image and deliver drugs that will kill the cancer cells. So if I put all this together, and this is a nice figure done by Donnellan, who's sitting here, these are the our approach to the problem that we will develop. Well, I say we will develop, but we are already developing here. So we will focus in the modulation of the early innate immune response. And our initial focus is on interferon and on TYK2, which is a kinase downstream of interferon alpha. And we just got a grant together with Carmela Evans Molina to test drugs that block TYK2 as an idea to repurpose them to type 1, because they are already used in psoriasis. And we are also discussing with our colleagues in Lilly, because they are also interested in this. So this may lead to a three-way collaboration. We are working on regeneration pharmacology with focus on inducible pluripotent cells. We will continue the work of biomarker developed with the ultimate goal of theranostics, imaging, and targeting. And we also have basic research related to the biology of the beta cell and the pathway regulation. So these are more or less the research lines that we are going to pursue here. And one last point that I would like to raise, because the goal of the discussion, besides showing some of the research that is ongoing, is to how discuss together how to attract people and create a research institution that moves medicine forward. I have been thinking, and well, I happen to teach a course in scientific communication in Belgium and some other place, so we usually discuss the things. So I think the thing that we need is a top infrastructure which allow development of new methods of producing scientific knowledge. I think this infrastructure is already in place at the IBRI. I think the lab is very well equipped. We need novel approaches to train scientists, and this is something that we can discuss. I think starting at the level of biomedical science or medical school, we should stimulate and support creativity and innovation instead of focusing in memorizing textbooks. And once you have these things, and things are moving, and you have together a lot of intelligent and active people, you have this innovation and exciting that surrounds an emerging research field. I remember I did my postdoc in Sweden, And it was a fantastic period. We were a lot of people more or less the same age, in our early 30s. And everybody worked as mad. We used to have lunch together on Saturday because everybody was in the lab and nobody was complaining that we worked in the evenings that we come Saturday. It was just such an exciting time. And I think this is this time of feeling that we need to create. We need to attract people, gifted individuals with the personality and vision to make things happen. And I think we need to have a positive and stimulating competition. This is what I call the Beatles approach. For those of you that like rock and have followed the career of John Lennon and Paul McCartney, they are both fantastic musicians, but none of them alone reached the fantastic level that they reached together. And why was this? I heard a couple of interviews with them. It's very interesting to listen. They were always competing, but competing in the nice way. They were always trying to improve themselves and each other's music. And by working together, they were able to generate some of the most beautiful music that were ever done. And then when they were on their own, they were okay, but they didn't reach the same level. So I think we should aim for this Beatles approach to the research field. And the data that I showed, of course, is not generated by myself alone. We have already in our group here, Donald and Schoener, who is sitting here and who joined us in the podium, Annie Pinheiros and Bill Carter. Teresa has her own research group, but we do a lot of work together. These are all the other people with whom we collaborate. And this is the financial support that I have. And one of the things that I am doing now is to write grants as a madman to raise funds, additional funds here. But I am very grateful to the IBRI who is providing us starting up funds to have these people in place, buy equipment, and have the supplies for the initial 2 years. I thank you very much for your attention. If you have any questions before we move to the general discussion, perhaps it will be more specific questions for this part, and then we'll discuss together. We focus on the how to generate this Beatles scientific group that we are aiming at.
Thanks, Desio. First question might be, with your new anti-interferon drug, where would you, in your first trial, want to intervene? Would that be in SIBs of people with type 1? Would it be, you know, in the grace period? Where do you think you'd be effective?
That's a very good question. Ideally, I would like to use the interferon alpha blocker in people who are autoantibody positive but still normal glycemic. And these people can be identified today. So for instance, this trial that I showed was in they are not yet patients, they are normal glycemic. But this will be the ideal group. In real life, most probably the first trials will be in people who just developed a disease. Because we have data now with other RNA sequencing of islets from type 1, showing that even after the disease starts, there remain an interferon alpha signature. So it seems that the process of the disease is going on. And we now know that, for instance, 50% of the type 1 diabetic patients, for people, for instance, that develop disease and unfortunately die and you do histology, you see that half of them have 30 to 40% of the beta cell mass. But the beta cells are not working. So it is as if they are stunned by the immune system. So even at that stage, at least in theory, it may be that these blockers of interferon alpha signaling is going to work. The point to keep in mind is that type 1 diabetes, as other autoimmune, is multifactorial. So I don't think there will be one therapy that will serve for all patients. We probably need to use combination therapies, and we'll probably need to use tailored therapies, so individualized medicine. But we are not yet there. Hopefully, in some more years, we will be.
So I'll ask another question. I think it's interesting that you see in type 1 that the metabolic genes, they're really not a major contributing factor, but I would suspect that in type 2, at least when they're hyperinsulinemic, the metabolic genes maybe play a bigger role in the dysfunction.
Yes.
Maybe you could comment on that.
This is very interesting. This paper that I mentioned that is in press, we did a comparison between the type 2 and the type 1. In type 2, as you say, most of the genes that we detect are involved in beta cell growth, function, and insulin release. But the other thing that is interesting is that in type 2, you can detect them under basal condition. You don't need to open the chromatin for this purpose. And so, for instance, when you do EQTL, which is a way to look at the impact of candidate genes on gene expression, in type 2 diabetes, you can do this under basal condition. You don't need to stress the islets. In type 1, you don't see them unless you use an inflammatory stress. And one thing, this is something that we are doing in Europe, Miriam Knopp, who was here in July, is leading. We created a depository of human islets called TIGER, where we are pulling together human islets from Boston, from Belgium, from Pisa, UK, and Canada. And we have already 600 human islets preparation, and in all of them, the individuals have been genotyped. So we will be able to look, let's say, at correlation between genetics and gene expression. And I think by early of next year, we will reach 1,000 people, 1,000 donors. And I think for the first time, we'll really be able to look. The problem is that all these individuals or all these islets, they are under basal condition. They are not stressed. So for it will be wonderful for type 2. For type 1, I don't know what it will give. But one thing that I am, we are just doing this now. What I am, I asked our bio informatician, because we cannot stress them in vitro. But if you look at the body mass index of the donor, if you have somebody who is massively obese and where the beta cells need to work as hell to compensate for the insulin resistance, I assume that they will be stressed. So if we compare islets from obese people against people with normal body weight, we may have an in vivo stress that will allow us to detect EQTL. But I really don't know. We're just doing this now.
So it doesn't surprise me that the JAK trial would probably be newly diagnosed type 1 diabetics, because you do have, when you're looking at things like autoantibody presence and things like this, you have this intent to treat problem of taking a drug like a JAK inhibitor that's not going to be completely benign and treating a lot of people that are autoantibody positive but may not progress. And so you're giving a drug to somebody who will actually never get type 1 diabetes. So how do you perceive the opportunities for closing those gaps, either through better detection, better prediction of who's going to progress to type 1 diabetes beyond just simply a partial or even complete autoantibody signature, or safety and therapy, beta cell specific, exactly what the actual endpoint phenotype really is. Is it saving beta cells? Is it restoring beta cells? And what are those possibilities?
Yeah, this is a key question for two reasons. We are dealing with children or adolescents, so we need to be extra careful what we give to them. And we have a therapy, insulin therapy, that works. So we need to have something better and safe. The point is that today, if you take an individual who has two or three autoantibodies, and these there are very large studies, you follow them, by 10 years, more than 80% has developed a disease. So the idea is that once we have two or three antibodies, everybody will get the disease. It's just a question of time. And this justified this paper that I studied, because there they used a heavy anti-T-cell drug in people who were only autoantibody positive. But if you remember the curve, in the control, everybody was getting the disease. So I think autoantibodies already provide a very fairly good idea. And for instance, if you look at other diseases, for instance, if you look at hypertension, you treat hypertension to prevent cardiovascular disease and stroke. But it's not everybody who is hypertensive who will develop. So it's a trade that we do. So I think if somebody has an 80 to 90% chance to develop a lifelong and very serious disease, I always do the test of my own children. If one of my sons would be in this situation, I think I would probably use one of the available drugs already as a trial, taking into account all these things.
So just to just to clarify, did you say that those patients who are interferon alpha positive but normal glycemic have an 80% chance of?
No, sorry, I mixed it up.
That
is not interferon alpha. So these are people who develop antibodies against the beta cells.
Okay.
So this means that there is an autoimmune disease going on. What is fun is that, for instance, if you have just one autoantibody, the risk of disease is 5 to 10% over 10 years. So what are these people? Are people that have a little bit of autoimmunity and were able to control, or it's just noise? We just don't know. But when you move from one autoantibody to two or three autoantibodies, then the risk goes to 80%. And the autoantibodies are not doing the killing. They are just markers. So the actual killing is done by T cells, mostly CD8 and the macrophages.
That's a remarkable biomarker prediction.
Yes. Actually, there was a proposal which is now being largely accepted, where diabetes is being reclassified in three stages. In four stages. So stage one is genetic risk, which is not sufficient to justify therapy. Stage two is autoantibody positive, two or three autoantibody positive. Stage three is autoantibody positive plus glucose intolerance. And stage four is full disease. And it's considered, is starting to be considered, the field is changing, that is acceptable to use mild drugs in patients at stage two. But this is still debatable.
So now I'm going to switch gears entirely and go back to the very beginning of your talk. You referred to our preclinical models not being great predictors. So is part of the plan looking at how can we better leverage what we have available and also look for better predictors of in the preclinical stages?
Yes, this is something that I have been doing for many years together with Raghu Mirmira. And actually, it's unfortunate that I come here and Raghu moves to Chicago, but anyway, that's life.
Well,
Chicago is not far away. We'll continue to work together. We have been for many years trying to look at circulating biomarkers of both autoimmunity and beta cell death. And he has already identified some very interesting biomarkers. And he's just writing this paper now. We're just discussing together. So I think the mouse models are very valuable. And for instance, many of the drugs that we're going to discover, we'll need to test in the mouse model. So this project together with Carmela, I am testing these JAK inhibitors and TYK2 inhibitors in human islets, and Carmela is going to test in mouse models. But what I am trying to do is to work in a different way. So what people have been doing is that they look at the mouse model to discover pathogenesis of disease, and then they try to treat. What I do is look at the human disease, at the human pancreas, and at human islets to understand pathogenesis, identify pathways, and once I have the pathway, and once I have the drug, I go to the mouse. So the mouse come at the end, not at the beginning. And I used the mouse in parallel with human islets of Langerhans. And this is something that I say that always shocked people. I, at that stage of my life, I trust more in a human islet experiment in vitro than in a nod mouse experiment in vivo. But this is very debatable. I would say 80% of the immunology of diabetes community will not agree with me, but they make their living by nod mice. I stopped it by now.
So one last question. So in our pet animals, their diabetes occurs spontaneously. And there's potentially an opportunity to leverage data that we could generate from those spontaneous cases that may help us as we move forward in the human area as well. Have you had much thought
but
about
which,
that?
But which animal model are you speaking of, nod mice or other models?
I'm talking about spontaneous diabetes that occurs, for example, in pet dogs, companion animal dogs, and in cats. And the dogs typically get it more of a type 1 type of diabetes. It's a little different than a human. But
it's interesting. This could be a valuable model. The problem is cost and how to make it practical. So, I am a little bit on the old side. So I was involved in the beginning of the BB rats story, and then not mice come. And the way the work goes is that it starts, somebody, a laboratory assistant, detected that the cage was wet. So the rat was urinating too much. So this colleague has the brilliant idea, instead of killing the rat, to measure glucose in the urine. And the rat was glycosuric. And so it was a spontaneous mutation that generated a type 1-like model. So the next step is to breed these mice to make them these rats, and then the same with mice, make them as homogeneous as possible. So. And then we reach the stage where they are, the mice, they are like identical twins, which is good, it makes research easier, but it's different from humans. We are not all identical twins and we are not inbred. So one problem, for instance, if you have a spontaneous diabetes in dogs, we'll have an N equal to 1. So how are you going to study? If we want to study, we would need to start breeding the parents of this dog?
I think that it can be done in more of a clinical trial modality and actually recruit patients. It's more
and how many can you get?
Pardon me?
How many can you get? It's a frequent phenomenon.
How many do you need? it's a fairly common disease. And
there is something called a power analysis, so we can do a power analysis. In real life, if you have around 10 dogs and 10 controls, especially from the same litter, but we need to do a power analysis.
Yes.
And actually, there is something interesting. There are TYK2 inhibitors that has been developed for dogs, because dogs have a skin disease that is an autoimmune disease that is mediated by interferon alpha. And another thing that is funny is that the human TYK2 inhibitor, it's used for some leukemias also, it costs $100,000 per year for humans. In the mouse, it costs in the dog, it costs $6,000 for reasons that are a little bit difficult to explain. But so the dog would be a good model to test the TYK2 inhibitor, and there is already a drug for dogs. We'll just need to raise funds to pay $6,000 per dog, but this is doable.
So let me bring up the panel and introduce them. So first we have Donalyn Schoner, who's a senior staff scientist at the RBRI. We have Jonathan Flack, who recently joined us and is a senior staff scientist. And then we have Desio. And so what I'd like you to, if you could, to start this panel is take 3 to 5 minutes and tell us what attracted you to the IVRI Diabetes Center or the area here, and also maybe for Donalyn and Jonathan, give us a little bit of information about what you're doing here. We'll let Desio have a break on his voice there for a minute since we know what he's doing.
So my name's Donalyn Schooner. I come from a background.
Sorry, if you use that, they catch it on the podcast. It should be on.
Okay. I come from a background of cell biology and mouse genetics, and looking at stress responses in cells. And as you've heard from Desio, perhaps one of the most serious stress responses that a cell can undergo is attack by the immune system. And in the process of doing our studies, we discovered a really important biological stress sensing mechanism that's tied to diabetes. And that brought me from the University of Michigan and the Howard Hughes Institute there to Eli Lilly, where I ran drug discovery efforts looking for new targets and building teams to prosecute those targets. And over the years, I also maintained my associations with other diabetes scientists in the academic community. And when I left drug discovery, I contacted Raghu Mirmira, and it turned out that Desio was coming to Indianapolis to start a research program. And it was, you know, the best opportunity in the world I could have imagined to transition from drug discovery then to working with Desio to look for potentially new mechanisms to treat type 1 diabetes. And what's really unique about the IVRI environment is that it's small, so it's agile. You can move fast. You have the ability to do basic research that you can't do at a drug company, but yet you have the resources when you need them to transition back into the environment of thinking about something as a therapeutic and looking for expertise that really doesn't exist in an academic laboratory to evaluate a target and move it forward. And those kinds of expertises are relationships that I still have and I know where to look for. So the nice thing about IBR is it positions you in a place where you can have the best of all worlds, and I'm really excited about that.
I'm Jonathan Flack. So I come from a lab at the University of Michigan, and my postdoctoral work was on focusing on revealing a neural circuit in the brain that responds to hypoglycemia that can drive the mobilization of blood glucose in order to normalize glucose in a hypoglycemic condition. And what I'm interested in my work that's funded by the American Diabetes Association is to understand to uncover this neural circuit and how this signal gets all the way from the brain to the periphery in order to drive this mobilization of blood glucose that's really important in all of us in order to prevent us from dangerous levels of hypoglycemia. So in that, a lot of my experience and expertise comes in understanding how the brain controls overall metabolism. And as I've been studying this circuit, actually it's a lot of these brain areas aren't necessarily only controlling glucose metabolism, but also they control energy expenditure as well. So I'm really interested in understanding what are the components of these neural systems that overall control sympathetic nervous system in order to drive glucose mobilization, glucose uptake, and energy expenditure. So the question is, well, what drew me to Indiana? Well, it's a combination of some of the things Desio talked about is just the current infrastructure in place, the critical mass in studying diabetes as well as neuroscience. And in addition to that is just the sheer potential in the area, not only the potential of my research, my expertise of directions that I could take that at Indiana, but also the potential at the IBRI and avenues to potentially collaborate with those in industry as well and take my research in directions that I can't predict.
Thanks, Jonathan. I guess I would point out for those who two things. The first is that currently IBRI in the Diabetes Center is focusing on two areas. That's really beta cell and pancreatic function. And then Jonathan's our first recruit in the other major area that we're focusing on, which would be central control of metabolism. So we're hoping to build in those two areas as we go forward. So hence, seems like Jonathan doesn't have anything to do with what Desio and Donalyn are talking about, but he does. So, and then the other thing just to add about the environment is that, and to put a plug in for the school, and that is that we have one of the 16 NIH-funded diabetes centers in the nation. So we are at the five-year renewal for that center. It's very prestigious to get one. We got that back again 5 years ago by knocking out another center. So if we survive competitive renewal here, which we feel very strongly about, I think that adds to the environment here, and it adds to this interaction between the IBRI with IBRI in between industry and the school here. So I just add that plug in there. Are there questions from the audience for our panel about, you know, how they see growing the biosciences industry environment here in Indiana, or more specifically about what they're doing? Because if there aren't, then, you know, I'm going to go to my canned questions, so you might have something more interesting to ask. So, sure.
So when you think about the different ecosystems or places where you've been part of the research community, and you think about what you see in Indiana and Indianapolis, are there opportunities to create or bring new programs or concepts into our ecosystem that we don't currently have? So what are the opportunities you see that we need to create or seed that would continue to strengthen the life sciences and in general and in the diabetes space?
Perhaps I can start, I think, discussing with Raghu and Carmela. As I told, I have been collaborating with them for many years. One thing that was missing here is an inducible pluripotent cell core, particularly in the beta cells field, but we also develop neurons, so this can be used. So one of our goals here is to develop this core. So we got support from the IBRI together with Bill and Donalyn, already purchased and all the basic equipment. And I think in the coming 2 or 3 weeks, we will start to differentiate inducible pluripotent cells. So our hope is by next year to be fully functional, produce not only beta cells, but then start collaborating, for instance, colleagues interested in neurons that can also be developed. So I think this is one of the things that can be used not only by the IBRI, but the IU and other universities.
I'll go next. So I think there's a lot of potential in connecting some of the pieces of infrastructure that are already in place. I think one area of really exciting that I think is an area that has a lot of potential is connecting some neurodegeneration aging with metabolic research, which I think, at least in my conversation with colleagues, is an area that's really unexplored. So that's one area that at least I'm interested in at least exploring to see if there is potential collaborations and ways in order to connect with some of the strengths at the Stark Neuroscience Institute in those areas and connecting with some of the strengths in diabetes research here.
His interest in human islet biology enables us to start collaborations at IBRI now, where we're bringing a large human islet program to the institution, where we'll have human islets coming with really significant frequency to our laboratory. And we're going to be working with our collaborators to use some of the technologies that I utilized when I was in industry to do assay development so that those islets can be analyzed, and then that information can be used basically to inform all of the investigators that are using the islets on the nature of the preparations that they have and we're doing assay development that will benefit a number of other investigators that are going to be in the IU environment that we're working with, for example, Carmela, and also the new beta cell biologists that are coming to IBRI. So there's a space to capitalize on some of the larger scale assay development skills that exist in IBRI and use it for the new investigators and use it to benefit the whole research community. And then bringing, by doing, with the human islet program, it makes us more visible to the outside world. So it makes IBRI and IU and the whole Indiana ecosystem even more visible, which I think is important.
If I may add just one thing regarding collaboration with industry. So Donalyn, myself, and Carmela, we have been, since the beginning of the year, in discussion with Ruth Gimeno and Melissa Thomas at Lilly. And they put us also in touch with their immunology department. So the game there is to see which drugs are they developing for other autoimmune diseases that can be repurposed for type 1. And we have already two candidates. We already wrote a project together. And we are waiting for their final answer, which we hope will be positive. So if it is positive in the coming weeks or couple of months, we'll be working together in an intensive way.
Hello, so my name is Stacey Weaver. I'm a student in Carmela Evans Molina's lab. And great talk, Desio. One big gap that I'm starting to see in the diabetes industry is a lot of people are focused on how to stop the progression of type 1 or just stop the development altogether. Are there any research arms going on through the IBRI or an industry whatsoever about things for people with long-standing type 1 diabetes, such as better treatments, better insulins, how to prevent hypoglycemia from too much insulin, a lot of opportunity in the pump industry for different algorithms to do a closed loop system. Are you guys working on those aspects at all, or is it more geared towards pre-diabetic or if you're at risk for developing type 1?
I am not working on this, so I am sure that Lilly is working and Novo also very hard to develop novel insulins. And yesterday, actually, I was reading a paper in New England of a prospective trial of a closed loop system. So it's ways to measure glucose continuously and deliver insulin. And this was done over a 6 months period, and the results were positive. So I think there is a lot of research going on in this direction. I am not personally involved on it. I am still sticking to the idea that maybe it's better to prevent the disease if it's possible. But of course, I think we need to work hard to develop better therapies for people who already have the disease.
I can address that question. We do have one major scientific team at IBRI. They work in the area of bioanalytics and developing very sensitive methods for detection of different analytes. And they're starting a new research program working in the area of wound healing, which is a significant issue for many diabetic patients.
So at least the hypoglycemia aspect is something that's a major focus of my lab, what it's going to be going forward. And certainly one of the main problems with treating type 1 diabetes is the onset of hypoglycemia. That find recurrent episodes that patients become more and more susceptible to hypoglycemia. And certainly there's a model that I study, at least within mice, that treat the animals with continuous doses of either glucoprivation or insulin, that those animals become less responsive. Now it's believed that there's some brain system that learns that this is no longer a dangerous acute stressor and diminishes that response over time, but the exact contents, so at least are not known at this time. So at least when I'm interested, at least on a more basic end and trying to just develop what the circuit is, what the components within that circuit is, that's something that's certainly that I'm studying.
Really,
And certainly at Michigan, that was something that we collaborated with Novo Nordisk on, understanding some of the components of that, as the goal being, if you can find something that can normalize that circuit that's no longer functional, and then co-transmit that with insulin, that could to create a potentially safer insulin. Now, obviously, that's pie in the sky. That's very long-term goals. We're at a very basic end of just understanding what the physiologic response is. But hopefully someday that's one potential goal, that you could create a safer insulin.
I'm Xiao Wang, come from the Udemy Consulting. Thanks for all of your speaking. So I have the question, do you think the fasting has the effect of the immune system and the diabetes? Thanks.
How long fasting?
So normally that called the light fasting or intermittent fasting, just looks like one day, or normally for the between the 18 hours or 8 hours, like this.
That's like, perhaps I can start the answer. This is a very interesting subject. There was a paper in Cell a few weeks ago where they did a first systematic study in humans comparing intermittent fasting. So people would fast either every other day or during the whole day. And it seems to have a major impact on metabolism. They didn't look at the immune system, immune function, but they claim that several parameters connected to insulin resistance and lipid release were improved. If this will be confirmed or not, it remains to be seen. So there are a lot of studies in animal models suggesting that, for instance, alternate fasting prolongs life. Although one question that you may ask is it worthwhile to fast just to get a couple of extra years? I'd rather prefer to eat a nice steak than to live tomorrow. Anyway, this is a philosophical question. But there is something on it. So there are very serious work that is being done at the highest level, including for the first time prospective studies with adequate control groups. And I think this is something that will come in the coming years. So for metabolism, for sure, I think there seems to be an impact. How long-lasting it is and how positive it will be is still an open question. On the immune system, from my knowledge, there is not much known. But this may be my ignorance.
Could I follow up with that a little bit? So at least in humans, so when you think about animals, alternate day fasting is easy, right? Because we give them the food or we take it away. So you can see these remarkable effects. The Selmet paper shows that you can get those effects in humans, but generally speaking, a lot of the alternate fasting in human studies have been sort of inconclusive. Because one of the problems with us is we alternately fast and then we make up for the calories on the next day. So you have to be pretty strict. I mean, people can do it, but just a general population, it's a lot like dieting. When we diet, we don't really diet. So it's harder for us to do. I think the animal work suggests that you could get an effect, but it's how do we get people to essentially do what we can make the animals do. So and that involves a lot more about behavior than just metabolism. So. Anything else from the audience? Another question over here.
So hi, thank you all so much for speaking. I'm a PhD student at Purdue University in the Biomedical Engineering Department, and I want to ask a quick question about kind of the iPSC core specifically. I'm curious to learn what types of resources will be available from the iPSC core for the IU and IVRI ecosystem, and kind of what ways, you know, even Purdue University could get involved with that particular program.
So I can tell you where we are now. So when I come here, I started our work together with Donald and Bill in July. And in the discussions, one of the things that I noticed was that it would be great to have an IPS core. So this was not in our original agreement. But we had a lot of discussions, and I was very happy to see the flexibility at the IBRI side. So I presented to the board the idea, they approved it, so they provided the funding. So we bought all the equipment for, let's say, to start inducible pluripotent cells. So Bill and Donovan has been putting things in place. So all the equipment is in place. The first two IPS-derived cell lines will be sent on Monday from Belgium. We developed it there so we can send it here. And I think in the coming week or two, they will start differentiating into beta cells. So at that stage, it's a small story. So what I intend to do is to apply for additional funds to the IU, considering that the IBRI already put a lot of money on it, to see if we can get matching funds to amplify it, to hire at least one additional person, increase the number of hoods. And once we have this in place, we can start functioning as a real core, not only develop IPS-derived beta cells, but for instance, if you want to develop a neuron, we can help you. We can show you how it works. You will come in and you will do the work. So that's the ultimate goal. But for the time being, we are still at the small enterprise level, but it's happening. And our experience, because we did this in Belgium, we started 4 or 5 years ago, I had the erroneous impression that the method was already well established, which is not the case. We suffered as hell to have this running. It took 1 or 2 years, but now it's already going. But again, it started as a very small thing. It was one lab. Now we have 3 labs. We started just doing beta cells. Now we are doing beta cells, neurons, liver, and we may collaborate with a group to develop muscle cells. So my hope is that we can have a similar life story here.
Traveled to Brussels and spent several weeks there immersed in the culture of the operation of the stem cell laboratory there, having the benefit of, you know, being there firsthand, learning all of the techniques. And this complements Bill's expertise. He spent 14 years managing a core laboratory at IU for the generation of transgenic and engineered mouse models. So he has an extensive experience culturing mouse embryonic stem cells, which have some similarities in their properties to the pluripotent stem cells that we're handling now. And those skills have been marvelously transferable. And, you know, it was a delight to see that Bill's first differentiations, which is a really arduous process, went all the way from beginning to end to the stage 7 that Decio was showing in his descriptions today. And I spent quite a number of years at the University of Michigan, where Jonathan also trained, working with the transgenic core facility there and doing embryonic stem cell biology work. So it's really exciting for us to come and put this together. And with those skills and managing a previous core facility, I think we'll be able to deliver what Decio is describing with the, you know, the very best that we do. We're going to dig right into that.
One last point, so besides Bill and Donalyn, my best postdoctoral fellow, who's the guy who's leading our IPS, there is moving in here. So he should be here in November as soon as he gets his visa. And he'll be here full time. So we'll have a team of people, which hopefully can grow.
I think you can amplify that, the part of your question a bit, and extend it to how does Notre Dame get involved? I mean, the diabetes focus today is a bit IU heavy because of the nature of the collaboration and such, but it is a success goal of IBRI to collaborate with all the universities. In fact, there's already a lot of paperwork on the back end of how do collaborations work, who signs off, what stuff, general collaboration agreements have already been signed with Purdue and with Notre Dame and other schools. And it's even gone so far as to say, let's say that this project is a smashing success, how do you even handle the IP that's generated? So if IBRI functioned as a closed building and was incredibly successful, impactful in a lot of areas, it would still not be 100% successful if it didn't do so through extending its outreach to the area universities.
Anything else? Okay, then I'd like to invite Vanessa back up to close.
Bob, well, first off, welcome to our newest members of the diabetes research community. And thank you to our sponsors, again, IBRI, Miles Printing, and Indie Science Connect, and a special thank you to our host, IUPUI, for the lovely facilities. I'm going to put a plug in again for InScience. I think we have another. Does the slide pop back up for me? Because I have not memorized the number to text to. But please join that online virtual community so you can stay in touch with what's going on. And then lastly, mark your calendars, which means, yes, pull your phone out again. November 19th is going to be our next framework session. It's going to be focused again on the life sciences community. We are going to be taking a look at entrepreneurism and mentoring. And so we have some exciting news that we'll be announcing and not to like steal the thunder, but a program that we are launching in conjunction with a partnership across all of the major universities in the state. So we're very excited about that. So if you know entrepreneurs in life sciences, if you're thinking about being an entrepreneur in the life sciences, if you want to give back and share your expertise in an entrepreneurial fashion, and that does not have to be focused on the life sciences, we need those diverse perspectives around the table so we can continue to accelerate innovation in our state. So with that, we'll close the session. They say be brief, be bright, be bold, and be gone. So please stay to network and mingle a bit and have a wonderful day.